So when we think of being on a mission, oftentimes we have these images that come up in our mind. You know, we think of being on a mission and like a war movie or going into battle or doing something like that. Or when we think of mission, we think of, you know, Tom Cruise dangling from a rope. One of the missions that I witnessed recently was, if you think of a mission, go to the card section in Giant the night before Valentine's Day, and you will see men who are on a mission looking for something. And so that's kind of, lots of times when we think of a mission, we think of images like that. Or maybe if you're in kind of a corporate leadership role, when you think of mission and message, you think of things like, you know, what your organization is all about and how you communicate that to people. There are all sorts of different things. And this morning, we're going to look at our personal mission and the message that we portray in life. And when I started thinking about this, I immediately began thinking about a friend of mine from college, or a guy who I met in college who would eventually become just a wonderful friend that I had. And I've shared this before, that when I was in college, I had this great opportunity as I was getting ready to enter into ministry, where there was a professor who was a guy who was great at mentoring and kind of great in small group relationships and things like that. And so he sought out a few people to mentor. It was really from every other class. He would normally have kind of two groups going on at a time, because it's a lot of work if you're really going to invest. And so there'd be like 10 or 11 guys who would be split up between these two groups that were being mentored by him. And most of the time we met separately. You know, we'd meet for lunch, we'd meet, kind of have one-on-one times where we would meet with him and things like that. But occasionally we would go on retreats. And it was normally like once a year, where both of the groups would come together and they would go on a retreat together. And so after I had been in one of these groups for a couple of years, we were going to go on a retreat with a group of new guys, a group of younger guys, just to kind of get to know them and to spend time together. And so we set up this time where we were all going to meet together, and we were going to talk about logistics for this trip. And I remember vividly that I was there. I was waiting in kind of like a little, you know, it wasn't the main dining hall, kind of like a smaller cafe dining hall. And I was waiting for this meeting to start. And this guy walked in to our meeting, and I was immediately kind of put off by him in the first impression. And the reason was that he was rocking this kind of fashion that I had never experienced or seen before. When he walked in, he was wearing not one, it wasn't just that he was wearing, you know, a bright pink polo shirt and had the collar popped on it, but it was that he had two polo shirts on with popped collars, a bright yellow and a bright pink polo shirt. And I can still kind of remember the way it looked. And they both had popped collars, and it was just kind of this look, this kind of thing I had never witnessed or seen before. And it was only later on that I would find out that this was kind of like a thing, that in the late 90s, early 2000s, there was kind of a preppy frat boy sort of fashion look where one popped collar just was not enough. And so you needed to get a few popped collars in there to help your look out. And if you don't believe me, you think I'm making this up, I have a few examples for you today. Not only, you know, from there up, you know, maybe that's stylish. I can't imagine the frumpy nature. There's an actor as well in a movie kind of giving us that look. And those are some serious models who are displaying this look for us. And so if you've never witnessed that, never saw it, if you think maybe that was just a little like Western Pennsylvania kind of oddity, I submit for you 8-time Grammy winner John Mayer as someone who embraced this style for a while. So this was a thing that happened. I don't really know how it happened, and if you ever went through a phase where one popped collar was not enough, this isn't meant as an insult to you in any way, but for me, it was a little bit too much. When I walked in to that meeting, and I had, you know, my own past and my own history, which was one of a blue collar, kind of rural, pun intended, upbringing, and I looked at this guy, I thought, what is his deal, you know? Like I said, he's a great friend to this day. And then I started to kind of think, though, what's he all about? And as I got to know him, what I found out was that the double popped collars fit his personality perfectly. perfectly. That he would say, he would describe himself as someone who was very conscientious and very aware of his appearance, of the way that he looked to other people. That was something that was really important to him, to be well-dressed and to be kind of like right on the edge. And there's nothing wrong with that at all. Nothing wrong with enjoying fashion or liking to be well-dressed or anything like that. But he would say that he probably struggled in his life with just a little bit of vanity, of really caring about his appearance. And as I got to know him a little bit more, that kind of frat boy kind of personality was something that also fit him very well. You know, when after we had a few philosophy courses and things like that, he would speak a little more deeply about the way that he lived in the pursuit of pleasures and things like that. But when he came into college, he didn't really have kind of that language. He was just a guy who loved partying a lot. And he had this experience with Jesus. He grew up in a Christian family, had an experience at summer camp near the end of his high school, years, and felt, you know, that he was supposed to head into ministry. Didn't really have any idea what that meant, was still very kind of rough around the edges, would go home and then come back with stories about, you know, things he had done that he really regretted, would sometimes be on, you know, at campus and have stories about things he had done. And in a lot of ways, he didn't really fit this mold of what you think of when you think of someone who goes to college to study ministry. But I would say this, that over the course of years, there was this clear transformation that took place in his life. That was unmistakable. I mean, from the person he was, I'll just to share a little more, he was balding. And he was balding when he entered into college and was almost completely bald on top. And so initially he was always like shaved his head every day, was very clear about it. And then he kind of like lost some of that sort of sense of vanity. He certainly grew in the sense where he wasn't always kind of seeking out his own pleasure. But if you asked him when going into college what his mission was in life, he would have said to look as good as he could and to have as much fun as he could have had. You know, and over years, that changed in him. And so when he left college, he was completely different than when he entered. And then he left and he went to seminary and he eventually went to Scotland to get a PhD in theology. And now he teaches at a college level and everything like that. And he's just a brilliant, really smart guy. But if you met him now with a tweed jacket, you know, you would never guess the kind of person that he used to be, even just the way that he used to look in life. And that kind of transformation is something that we've all sort of seen or witnessed in different people. You know, as people grow and mature in life, or as people go through hard experiences in life, sometimes our mission changes in life. You know, a lot of us probably know people who grew up very kind of, you know, narcissistic or self-absorbed or in the same way as my friend, someone who cared a lot about vanity or cared a lot about the pursuit of their own pleasure, and then kind of grew up a little bit and matured and moved beyond that. Some people know, you know, we know people who have struggled with addictions, and when they were in the midst of that struggle, you know, pursuing that addiction was really the mission of their life. Pursuing that rush was the addiction of their life, and then kind of as they moved out of that, their mission changed in life. And whenever you experience that change in a mission, it inevitably changes the message that you portray to people, whether it's through things that you say, through the way that you look, through the actions that you take towards other people. In life, we have our mission and our message that are very closely connected. And we're going to look at that a little bit in the story of Saul today in Acts chapter 9. And so as you're turning to Acts chapter 9, a few weeks ago when we were looking at the stoning of Stephen in the beginning of Acts chapter 8, we won't read this, but you might recall that it said that Saul was present at the stoning of Stephen, and it said that people were there and they were laying their coats at the feet of this young man named Saul. And so that's the first introduction that we have to Saul. And so that brings up two questions. Who is Saul and why are people laying their coats at his feet? And there are a couple things that we know about Saul before he becomes Paul and before his conversion experience or transformation experience. And the first is this, that he was a young man. We know that because in Acts chapter 8 it says they're laying their coats at the feet of a young man named Saul. It's speculated that at the time he's probably in his mid-30s. So he's kind of right in the same age as Jesus. He's probably born right around the same time as Jesus. And so for such a young man to be honored in this way, and to have people kind of looking to him, it means that in some way he was accomplished. And that's where things are a little less clear for us. We don't see a clear description of that, but in a society where your elders and your leadership was so highly regarded, to see people honoring Saul in this way means that he's a person who's accomplished in some capacity. Another thing we see about Saul is this, is that he's privileged. So even though we'll see later on in the story of Acts that Paul works to support himself, he's clearly someone who comes in with a sense of privilege. And part of it is in those first two bullet points. The first is that he's a Roman citizen from Tarsus. So Tarsus is in modern day Turkey, now, but so he is a Roman citizen, and as a Roman citizen, he's afforded certain rights and privileges that lots of people would not have had. And then not only was he a Roman citizen, but he's also part of an elite Jewish sect. He's a Pharisee. So he not only has the Roman citizenship, which you see throughout Acts playing as an advantage to him, he's also a well-educated Jewish person who's a Pharisee, who is just so concerned, committed, and so passionate about uplifting the law of the Old Testament, about living faithfully to the traditions and the customs of the Old Testament. And so, like I said, it explains later on in the book of Acts that he had a rabbi who was his teacher named Gamaliel. And so he's this highly educated person. So in that sense, he has privilege. And then in the third sense, he's a hustler. One of the definitions of hustler is an aggressively enterprising person, a go-getter. We can all think of people who are like this, people who are just kind of naturally go-getters and aggressive people in life. And if you read anything in the book of Acts from this point on, you begin to see this story that Saul, who eventually becomes Paul, is this aggressive kind of guy. So at points, even though he comes from a background of privilege, he works to support himself as a tent maker. So his mission is sharing the gospel. What he does to support that is get a job that allows him to be able to travel around and to do that work. We see he's tenacious as an author, as a scholar. That's part of the way we know he's well educated. But when you look at the New Testament, he's responsible for at least 13 of the 27 books. And there's speculation about the book of Hebrews. It doesn't follow that same kind of pattern. But so he's right there, wrote almost half of the books of the New Testament. So it's pretty impressive when we see what he's done. And then one of the most impressive things about Saul is that he lives on mission with a great deal of discipline. You see that in who he was as a Pharisee. You see that in the way he lived out passionately persecuting and trying to put down the Christian faith. And then the way that he passionately tries to preach the gospel and start churches and bring up leaders. You know, there's no way for us to know this, but people speculate that at the length of Paul's ministry, which is probably somewhere around 10 years or so, that he's a guy who was walking or traveling miles and miles every day in a society and in a time when travel just wasn't that convenient or easy. So he's someone who's committed to the goal. And so why are people laying their coats at the feet of this young man named Saul? Is it because he was responsible for the stoning of Stephen? Did he order that? We're not completely sure. Is it because he was the one who arrested Stephen? We see his pattern. We will read his pattern today, that he's someone who goes out arresting Christians. So it's possible that he's the one who kind of brings Stephen in to be questioned by the Sanhedrin. Or is it just that he's someone who's 100% kind of committed to this cause of ending the Christian church? We can't say for absolute certainty, but we know this, that Saul was passionately committed to fighting over and seeking out the laws of the Jewish faith, of the Old Testament. And he would do whatever it took, whether that was putting someone to death or arresting someone, arresting families and separating them. He would put them in prison to pursue that end. We see this in Acts chapter 8, verse 3. And this is the only verse we'll read before we get into Acts 9. It says this, "But Saul began to destroy the church. Going from house to house, he dragged off both men and women and put them in prison." And when you're reading through the story of Stephen, this is kind of like the end note of that story. You know, it talks about how people mourned for Stephen. It talks about how the church kind of begins to scatter under persecution. And then it says this line about Saul. But it's easy to kind of lose that in the story of Stephen. We're going to read it one more time. It says, but Saul began to destroy the church. Going from house to house, he dragged off both men and women and put them in prison. It doesn't say that Saul began to question Christians. It doesn't say that Saul began to express opposition to the Christian church. It doesn't say that Saul began to protest church meetings that were happening. It doesn't say that Saul desired in his heart to destroy the church. It says that Saul began the work of destroying the church. That he began going house to house, hunting for Christians and dragging them through, shaming them publicly as they were taken on their way to prison. It's incredible when we think about the fellowship of this early church. These are a lot of people outside of, you know, some of them that have been following Jesus for a time. These are a lot of people who are brand new in their faith, who are just kind of getting started into this life as a Christian. And then you have this person, Saul, who's saying, look, this is starting to spread like wildfire, and we need to put an end to this. We need to put this down as soon as possible. And when it says he's going from house to house, that is the church. He's going from church to church at that time. There are records of the church meeting in synagogues of Paul and some of the other apostles and disciples teaching in synagogues. But this is before any church structure is built like we have today. This is before, this is kind of as the church has fallen out of grace with Jews. So they're kind of kicked out of the synagogue. They're not going to meet anywhere publicly. This is all the only safe place the church has is being in their homes and meeting with each other there. And Saul is going door to door looking for these people to end them, to take them out, to put an end to this church. And so the question comes, why does Saul want to end the church, to destroy the church so badly? We have every reason to believe that he is doing this in a sincere attempt to please God. He's doing this in a sincere attempt to worship God and to uphold the law faithfully and to make sure that this heretical sect that is leading people away and out of the Jewish faith is ended as soon as possible. You know, as a Pharisee, we talk in our context about how in order to see that return of Christ, that's kind of this great end that we have hope in and that we're working towards as we seek to share the gospel with as many people as possible. And that's the same is true of Pharisees. You know, Pharisees were out there trying as hard as they could to get people to live faithfully in accordance with the law in order that Christ might, or that the Messiah might come and might deliver them from the problems that they were having. And so Saul is doing this. He is a sincerely devoted, committed Jew who's trying as hard as he can to see people faithfully follow the law. So when we think about his mission, it's this: to destroy the church by imprisoning or killing disciples of Christ. His mission in life is to end the church by killing people or having them arrested. And the message that the message that he sent out to people very clearly aligned with that when his message was to abandon the heretical beliefs of Christianity and faithfully follow the law, or I will hunt you down and throw you in jail. That's his mission and his message. And like I said, he's a hustler. He's a go-getter. He's passionate about what he's doing. And so he's going after this mission with everything that he has. And it's hard for us to draw a comparison in our culture today to this. You know, there's lots of talk about how as Christians, there are certain elements of culture that that are really opposed to the Christian faith, that certainly there are elements that are opposed to exclusive claims about Christ. There are kind of, ways where Christianity and some sections of culture at large struggle to see eye to eye or to get along. But this is a level of opposition and persecution. That, as I think about it, you know, I think maybe this is kind of what it was like, or what it is like in some areas of China, where Christians have to meet underground in homes or in private, so that the government can't arrest them and end their church fellowship. Maybe it's even closer to some of the horror stories that we've seen from ISIS over the past few years. As they'd enter into a village and they'd put a notice up and say, if you're a Christian, you have, you know, whatever, 24 hours to get out of here and to run, or else you're going to be arrested and potentially killed for the faith that you have. That's kind of the level of persecution that Paul's looking to inflict upon the church. And so at the beginning of Acts 8, we read about how that's taking place. And then we're going to start reading in Acts chapter 9, verse 1, about the mission of Saul. It says this: meanwhile, Saul was still breathing out murderous threats against the Lord's disciples. He went to the high priest and asked him for letters to the synagogues in Damascus, so that if he found any there who belonged to the way, whether men or women, he might take them as prisoners to Jerusalem. So we already read about how the church is spreading out, the church is moving as persecution has set in, the church is kind of going all over the place. And so Saul, who's in Jerusalem looking to persecute the church, says, this isn't good enough anymore. The church is scattered. I need to go out fleeing, kind of following them as they flee and seeking to bring them back here, put them in prison, and have them charged for what they're doing that's wrong. And it's not just that he wants them arrested. He's breathing out murderous threats. This is kind of a dead or alive sort of scenario that Saul's talking about in this passage. And so he gets approval to do this, begins traveling on the road to Damascus to seek out Christians and to arrest them and bring them back. And then we read this in Acts chapter 9, verse 3. As he neared Damascus on his journey, suddenly a light from heaven flashed around him. He fell to the ground and heard a voice say to him, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? Who are you, Lord? Saul asked. I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting, he replied. Now get up and go into the city, and you will be told what you must do. To pause there for a minute, when Saul says, who are you, Lord? He's acknowledging in this moment, he's beginning to understand that he's been wrong about what's taking place. And then Jesus identifies himself. And it says this, so he's told to get up and to go into the city, and he'll be told what he needs to do. And it says, the men traveling with Saul stood there speechless. They heard the sound, but did not see anyone. Saul got up from the ground, but when he opened his eyes, he could see nothing. So they led him by the hand into Damascus. For 3 days he was blind and did not eat or drink anything. And in Damascus, there was a disciple named Ananias. The Lord called to him in a vision. Ananias, yes, Lord, he answered. The Lord told him, go to the house of Judas on Straight Street and ask for a man from Tarsus named Saul, for he is praying. In a vision, he has seen a man named Ananias come and place his hands on him to restore his sight. Lord, Ananias answered, I have heard many reports about this man and all the harm he has done to your holy people in Jerusalem. And he has come here with authority from the chief priest to arrest all who call on your name. But the Lord said to Ananias, go. This man is my chosen instrument to proclaim my name to the Gentiles and their kings and to the people of Israel. I will show him how much he must suffer for my name. And so this is the story of Saul becoming Paul that we all know. This is that kind of incredible transformation story where a few really incredible things happen. Saul receives, this is something that we forget lots of times, Saul receives the forgiveness that Stephen asks for. As Stephen is dying, one of the things we often miss again, or we think is incredible, is that he prays for the forgiveness of the people who are killing him. And we see that happen in Acts chapter 9. Saul receives this incredible forgiveness that he certainly has done nothing to earn or deserve. The second is this: God shows up and speaks to Saul. This is another example in the book of Acts where God shows up, or where a divine messenger shows up and begins to speak to the people. And then, as is alluded to at the end, when God says that Saul will suffer for his name, God strikes Saul blind. He doesn't allow him to be able to see for a number of days as a result of what's taken place. But at the same time, he's calling him into ministry. So let's think about that for a moment. Saul is a faithful Jew. Saul has spent his life preparing to teach people and to lead people in what it looks like to live faithfully in accordance with the law. Saul is someone who is in ministry already. As Jesus shows up, though, he begins to call him to this new ministry. He speaks into who Saul is. He speaks into the things Saul has missed about the coming of the Messiah. And he begins to lead him into this new ministry. And so when Saul interacts with the gospel, there are three things that take place in his life. The first is this. He becomes informed about his identity. When Jesus appears to Saul and he begins to speak to him on that road, he's talking to someone who believes in God already, someone who's faithfully attempting to follow God already, someone who's serving God in ministry already. But Jesus shows up to him and says, Saul, why do you persecute me? Why are you doing these things that you're doing? How have you missed what's taking place in my coming as the Messiah? And through that time, Saul becomes informed on his identity. He begins to understand what he has been doing in his life is not the direction he was supposed to go. It's not what he should be doing. It's not how he should be living. And it changes his identity. His identity becomes transformed in this process. That's the second thing, that Saul becomes transformed in his actions, in the way he lives, in his mission, as he begins to understand the gospel, as he interacts with the gospel. As we think about mission, Saul is clearly does a 180 in being transformed in the mission that he's living out. And he still carries in all of those kind of personality pieces when he becomes a Christian. He still is well educated and teaches from the law. He still is someone who has the privilege of being both a Jew and a Roman citizen. He still is someone who's very clearly a hustler and a hard worker and a go-getter in what he's doing. He has all of those things, but his mission has absolutely been transformed in life as he interacts with the gospel and he begins to understand what he's done wrong and what he needs to do moving forward. And then the final thing is this, that Saul is conformed to the cause of Christ. It would be nice to say that when Saul has this incredible experience, that's the moment when he becomes Paul. That's what we oftentimes think about. There are lots of, you know, there are subtitles that might even say in your scripture, Saul becomes Paul. But it is not, you know, it's a big grand kind of event that takes place. It's one big time, but it is not until chapters later where Saul begins to be referred to as Paul. It's not this kind of immediate acceptance of this new convert. We see that in Ananias. When Ananias says, God, I don't think you want me to heal him. It's better that he's blind. Do you know what he came here to do to your church, to your followers? Then as Saul meets with the apostles, it's the same kind of story, where the apostles are not excited to accept Saul into the fellowship that they're experiencing. And it kind of, as he begins to preach the gospel, as his message is conformed to the cause of Christ, it's not met immediately with a warm reception. And when we read through in the book of Acts, it says that as the people are hearing Saul proclaiming the gospel, they're not saying, yes, we want to be a part of this. They're saying, isn't this Saul from Tarsus, who was going around arresting and breathing out murderous threats against the church? Isn't this Saul who, you know, as people are sitting there, they might be saying, isn't this Saul who arrested my cousin and his family? Isn't this Saul who was there, who was being honored as Stephen was being put to death just before these events kind of took place? Saul's message is conformed to the cause of Christ, but it takes a while for that message to be something that's heard and something that's really received. It says that after Saul has this transformational experience, that he leaves and he kind of goes out into the wilderness for a period on his own. It's no doubt in that time period that's where, and we don't know how long it was, that's where he began to be illuminated on all these passages from the Old Testament that explained how Jesus was the Messiah. And that's where kind of after it took some while for people to really begin to trust him and say, this isn't a guy who's kind of spying on us to get into our leadership and to take this whole thing down, that people begin to really trust Saul and begin to understand that his mission and his message in life has been conformed by the gospel, has been transformed by the gospel, that who he is has been informed by the gospel. We see this change happen dramatically. And what we see is that Saul is a person with a mission and a message. Before his transformational experience, his mission is to destroy the church, and his message is to leave the church or to face repercussions. And afterwards, his mission, as we see through Ananias, is to be the person who brings the gospel to the Gentiles, to be the mouthpiece of the gospel to the Gentiles. And what he immediately begins to do, it says, if we would continue reading in Acts 9, it says he meets with the Christians in Damascus for a few days, and then he goes into the synagogues and he begins to proclaim that Jesus is Lord. So his mission changes and his message changes just like that, and is shaped and moved by the gospel. And the reality for us is that lots of us have had this experience. You know, whether it was a huge kind of big experience that happened in an instant, like Saul has when God strikes him blind and calls him to live in a new way, or whether it's like my friend from college who it took kind of years of sort of seeking out Christ and refining and confessing that his life began to really take shape and to be transformed. We all have a mission and a message that we communicate in life that needs to be changed by the gospel, that needs to be conformed to the cause of Christ and transformed by the gospel. And so this morning, there are two questions that I want to ask us as we close today. The first is this: what are you living for? This kind of gets at our mission in life. And try to be honest in this. What are you really living for in life? What are you working towards in life? What is it that you love in life? What are you passionate about in life? Is it working towards material things, towards 401ks, towards comfort, towards lots of things that aren't bad, you know, lots of things that can be good, but are they the things that control your life that you live for, or is it for the cause of Christ? And the second question is this: what is your life communicating to others? We all put a message out there. With the words that we share, you know, with the way that we interact with people, with the way that we treat other people, what is the message that you're communicating? And the truth is this, that it's always connected with our mission. If our mission is to get as much stuff as we can, to be as happy as we can, then the message we communicate to other people is that we're takers and that we're selfish, you know. You know, that's just a reality. We might not say it out loud, but that's what happens. But when we're people who experience transformation like Saul does, and our mission is changed to be people who are living out our lives faithfully and our callings faithfully as Christians, our message, whether spoken or not, reflects that as well. So this morning, I'd encourage you to take some time to think about these two questions